From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, advocates for abortion rights are wondering about the future of Roe v. Wade. That landmark 1973 ruling will be put to a test after the Supreme Court decided that in its next term, it will hear an abortion case out of Mississippi. It will be the first abortion case to come before the court's new 6-3 conservative majority. Joining us now by Skype is Mary Ziegler. She's a legal historian and a professor of law at Florida State University. Mary, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So this case, it's a challenge to a Mississippi law that would ban almost all abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It hinges on the question of gestational viability. Could you explain what that means and why it's significant in this case?
Sure. So viability, in a nutshell, is that point in pregnancy when survival is possible outside of the womb. So that's most typically around the 24th week, although sometimes with heroic medical efforts, survival is possible as early as the 22nd week. Why it's significant is because ever since 1973, the Supreme Court has said that states may not ban abortion before viability, and that's been kind of a cornerstone of the court's abortion rights jurisprudence. Now, Mississippi's law, which bans abortion at 15 weeks, obviously does so well before viability, and that's the point in a way, because Mississippi wants to force the court either to reverse Roe v. Wade entirely or at least to get rid of viability as the point at which abortion bans are possible.
Okay, and that's why supporters of abortion rights and opponents are looking at this case as a potential milestone and that it could mean the end of Roe v. Wade. Do you think it could be that historic?
Absolutely. I think there's no reason the court would have taken this case unless it either wants to reverse Roe or reverse part of Roe, right? There's literally no way you can uphold this Mississippi law without at least rewriting the rules or rewriting what Roe stands for. And certainly, if the court is willing to go that far, there's no reason to think they'll stop there. Even if this is not the case that overturns Roe, I think the writing is on the wall down the road.
And so what are the range of options that we could be looking at? Either the court could overturn Roe or somehow significantly limit it?
Exactly, yeah. So in the past, in 1992, the court got rid of big parts of what Roe had stood for, basically the rules that would apply to determine the constitutionality of abortion laws, but kept what the court framed as the sort of essential holdings of Roe. And there were two of those. One, that there was a right to choose abortion, and two, that that right applied before viability. So it's possible that the court could say, actually, there's only one essential holding, and that's that there's a right to choose abortion, but this whole viability thing is a side note that we can get rid of. That would still be consequential, of course, because if viability is not the dividing line, it's not clear what is, right? Is it 6 weeks in pregnancy, as some red states have proposed in promoting heartbeat laws? Is it fetal pain, which Mississippi argues? Is there no limit, right? Can states just ban abortion throughout pregnancy? We just don't know what the court will do if viability is gone. So it kind of will open a Pandora's box, even if in theory the court has preserved some aspect of Roe v. Wade.
And this would be the first abortion case to come before Justice Amy Coney Barrett. The conservatives on this court have also shown signs that they're willing to overturn precedent. What does the new makeup of the court mean for this case?
One thing it means is that we have certainly have a new swing justice. Last summer, the court's first abortion case with a conservative majority made it seem as if Chief Justice John Roberts would be that swing vote. And Roberts, at least last summer, seemed reluctant to turn his back too quickly on the Supreme Court's precedents. But if the court is taking this case, there's reason to believe that either Barrett or Kavanaugh or both will be willing to go at a quicker clip in rolling back abortion rights than Roberts might have been prepared to do.
It's safe to say if you're a supporter of abortion rights, you're feeling nervous today.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and probably a little bit shocked, because, I mean, the Supreme Court has sat on this case since September of last year. And so I think many of us were expecting the court not to take this case and that we would maybe get an angry dissenting opinion from Clarence Thomas complaining about their kicking the can down the road. So the fact that the court not only agreed to take this case, but took up such an explosive question so quickly will definitely make supporters of abortion rights feel pretty uncomfortable today.
And 11 states have trigger bans in place. Now that means abortions will instantly be outlawed if the court overturns Roe. So big picture, what do abortion rights look like in this country if that happens?
According to the Guttmacher Institute and other researchers, we'd estimate that about half the states would ban all or most abortions if Roe were gone in one way or another, either through trigger laws or other statutes. There would be, of course, progressive states like Massachusetts that would expand access to abortion and probably make it easier to the extent possible for people from out of state to access abortion. And then there would be battleground states like Florida and Pennsylvania, where there would be lots of money and lots of energy invested to determine what abortion policy looks like. Of course, even in the Supreme Court, it wouldn't be over, because the end game for abortion opponents has never been allowing states to ban abortion. Because, of course, if you're a right to life supporter, you think that life begins at conception and abortion is murder if it's happening in Massachusetts or California as much as if it's happening in Alabama. So I would expect, even in the Supreme Court, that you would see abortion opponents coming back and saying abortion itself is unconstitutional and therefore cannot be allowed anywhere. In short, the fight will continue no matter what we see, and the kind of patchwork from state to state, the differences between states will become even sharper.
Mary Ziegler is a legal historian and professor of law at Florida State University. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're in the ninth day of violence between Israel and Hamas, the militant group that governs Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israel bombarded more targets overnight, hours after President Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he supported a ceasefire. Administration officials are speaking to Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the political group that governs Palestinians over in the West Bank. But Biden, like presidents before him, said he backs Israel's right to defend itself. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman has been traveling with Secretary of State Antony Blinken on a pre-planned trip to Arctic countries. She's in Iceland. And Michelle, to Biden's comments that he supports a ceasefire, other international leaders are demanding an immediate ceasefire. Why isn't Biden using stronger language?
Well, I mean, I think the sad reality is that, as we've seen in repeated cycles of violence between Israel and Hamas, they have to want a ceasefire for diplomacy to work. Israel has military objectives to degrade Hamas. And, you know, remember, Hamas has been firing rockets indiscriminately into Israel. And they're going to continue that as long as the Israeli strikes continue.
Well, and you're in Iceland right now, as we said, with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Why is he, you know, with such a crisis in the Middle East, why is he staying on this Arctic Council trip? It's to European countries. Why is he not pivoting?
I think there are a couple of factors at play. He has a high-stakes meeting tomorrow with Russia's foreign minister. Russia is about to take over the Arctic Council chairmanship from Iceland. The Arctic's one of the rare places that the U.S. and Russia can work together. So there is a lot of diplomacy, climate diplomacy, U.S.-Russia relations that are going on here. It's just that most of his calls have been with leaders in the Middle East.
Well, and he also says that the Biden administration has been working behind the scenes. Here's what Secretary Blinken told reporters today.
We are engaged in quiet but very intensive diplomacy. In an effort to de-escalate and end the violence.
Well, and we heard about the phone call with Netanyahu, but what is going on? Are there talks with Palestinians as well? And do we know if this diplomacy has accomplished anything?
Well, you know, there's a U.S. envoy, Hadi Amr, who's in the region and has met with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president. The trouble the U.S. has is that it doesn't talk to Hamas. So the conversations are really with Egypt, with Tunisia, with countries that have some ability to speak to Hamas.
And put this in context, the Biden administration has been in office 4 months in a pandemic. They haven't yet appointed an ambassador to Israel, sent a special envoy just last week. But mediating between Israelis and Palestinians hasn't been front and center. So what's been the recent history?
So the Trump administration's focus was on getting the Israelis and other Arab countries to recognize each other. And it was kind of putting the Palestinians off to the side. They didn't talk to the Palestinians. And so there was a lot of built-up anger from the Palestinians about the Americans. The Biden administration changed the policy on the margins. I mean, they're restoring aid to the Palestinians, but they're starting over. And in the meanwhile, this conflict has exploded. And it's not only, remember, this conflict between Hamas and Israel, there's also this communal, intra-communal violence within Israel that's very troubling, both to Americans, but also to Israelis.
Yeah, Israelis and Arabs fighting each other on the ground. Meanwhile, many progressives in the Democratic Party are condemning Israel, pointing out how much they've outgunned Hamas, how many more hundreds have died from Israeli strikes. They're objecting to the approved new U.S. arms sale to Israel. Could this pressure change Biden's attitude towards Netanyahu?
I think it could. I mean, U.S. military support for Israel has always had bipartisan support, but I think you are seeing a fraying within the Democratic Party on this issue, and that could draw Biden into a different position, although he has a very strong, longstanding view on Israel.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
Clinical trials have shown that the three COVID vaccines in use in the United States are highly effective at preventing illness that requires hospitalization. And now we're getting real-life data that prove that to be true. The Cleveland Clinic, which is a major hospital system in Ohio, says it's still seeing COVID patients, but nearly all of those hospitalized from January to April were not fully vaccinated. Let's bring in Dr. Stephen Gordon. He's chairman of the Department of Infectious Disease at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
And when you looked at these numbers between January and April of this year, what did you find out exactly about who is being hospitalized with COVID at this point?
You know, the two studies, what we found is patients hospitalized at the Cleveland Clinic healthcare systems with COVID, not surprisingly, over 97% did not complete vaccinations. So that is not a terrible surprise, I think, for most of us. The other study that was done was actually looking at the effectiveness of the mRNA vaccines in our own healthcare workers. And we, like many others, started in December. So over this period of time, which involved around 48,000 of our healthcare providers, about half of whom completed the two-dose vaccination series, what we found, as in others, is that the effectiveness for those healthcare providers that completed the two doses 2 weeks after the vaccine was over 97% in prevention of getting COVID-19. So nothing really new there, but I mean, this goes along with other effectiveness studies that have been done in healthcare providers.
So you say it's nothing new and you say it's no surprise. You know, that may be. The data suggested that it would play out this way, but you're now learning this in real life. Nearly 100% effective at keeping people out of your hospitals. I mean, that does say something about the effectiveness of this vaccine, doesn't it?
You know, we're now into the fifth month of experiencing the rollout of the vaccine here in the homeland. And I think this continues to build confidence, not just in healthcare providers, but in the public in general. And so we hope to continue that conversation in people who are not decided or potentially resistant, that they will, with more data, with more education, with what we'd say shared decision making, decide actually to get vaccinated.
The vaccines, we know, are not 100% effective at preventing all cases of the coronavirus. Some people who are vaccinated still do get it, though it is rarely severe enough to land yourself in the hospital, which is what we're seeing here. What are you hearing and seeing there in Cleveland about breakthrough cases?
Well, that's, I think, an excellent point. I think the first thing, Peter, I would say is that a year ago, you know, we were shutting down, and that was not to necessarily prevent people from getting infected, but preventing a surge of infection so that our healthcare systems were not going to be overloaded. And I would say with confidence now across the homeland, with the advent of vaccine primarily and other things, we are no longer going to face a surge of cases that the healthcare system won't be able to handle. It's not to say that we won't see COVID cases, and I anticipate we will still continue to see COVID cases over the next year. But that threat of overwhelming our healthcare system, I think, has now been severely diminished with the advent of the vaccine rollout. In terms of durability of protection and breakthrough infections, that's actively being looked at and will be looked at. And to date, we would state is that the issue of people getting reinfected requiring hospitalization in non-immunosuppressed patients is a very unusual event, although a lot of surveillance will go on to that. But when I'm speaking today, again, where we're seeing the cases of new COVID infections is in those people that are not vaccinated.
I see. I wonder if you or other doctors in your hospitals are having conversations with people who have been hospitalized with COVID and who haven't been vaccinated. And I wonder whether or not in that position, they wonder why they chose not to get the shot or if they've reconsidered their choices.
A very good question. I think, you know, we don't ever want to make people feel poorly or that it's their fault. Obviously, this is we've learned a lot of humility about COVID-19, myself included, in terms of this. And it still obviously can be a life-threatening pathogen. But I think the conversation, sometimes we can have those patients serve as maybe vaccine, you know, just more information. So peer-to-peer. The other thing that we're doing here is making sure our learners that that's part of the case presentation now. What's the patient's vaccine status? And to make sure that they've at least had that interaction with a white coat in terms of understanding what the hesitancy might be. Can we overcome that? And the third thing that we're going to be introducing, I think probably starting next week, is the concept of vaccination on discharge for those patients who have not received vaccine, but trying again to offer vaccination at time of discharge, similar to what we do with influenza during flu season.
Interesting. Do you think these numbers, this data we're talking about, will motivate more people to get vaccinated?
The hope is, of course, yes. Now we're kind of looking, what are the barriers? You know, as you know, Uber and Lyft are providing rides. We're talking about maybe providing PTO to get the vaccine and maybe PTO if you develop a fever or chills after the vaccine. Economic incentives as well. Here in Ohio, you know, we have the lottery. So I do believe, you know, we are trying to win over people one at a time, so to speak, meet them where they are. And as you know, even today, there's other barriers, urban versus rural, vulnerable populations versus not. So the pop-up clinics, but not leaving people behind. So a no today might turn into a yes tomorrow as we continue the rollout of the vaccine into different populations, such as the adolescents and the children.
You mentioned the lottery. That is Governor Mike DeWine making a $1 million jackpot available to five people who have been vaccinated. Dr. Stephen Gordon, chairman of the Department of Infectious Disease at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Well, now to a new report that concludes the U.S. is number one in companies that produce the most single-use plastic waste, plastic bags, bottles, face masks. The American-based company ExxonMobil is actually number one. Dow's up there as well. Two of just 20 companies responsible for more than half of the world's use-it-one-time-and-throw-it-away plastic. The Plastic Waste Makers Index was produced by the nonprofit Mindaroo Foundation in Australia with the London School of Economics and others. In addition to producers, they had a wasters list, and in that country division, the U.S. was second, only to Australia, in total single-use plastic waste. So, woo-hoo, a gold and a silver. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. So, Robin, you know, there was the list of the 20 companies that produced over half of the plastic waste, you know, single-use plastic waste. They also had a longer list, 100 companies produce 90% of global single-use plastic production. So, you know, how much does ExxonMobil make? What does the report say is the problem with that?
Yeah, these are multinationals with a significant stake in the continued growth of polymers and single-use plastics. I would call it the plastics industrial complex. And not many people realize that these plastics are overwhelmingly derived from fossil fuels, and the adoption has been surging across developing markets with new consumer classes that demand this stuff, but they just don't have the infrastructure to properly dispose of or recycle it. So it ends up maybe at best being incinerated. But we know, Robin, in South Asia and Southeast Asia, too often in rivers that empty out into the oceans. Even here in the United States, you can drive any interstate and witness the plastic bags persisting in trees year after year. Still, despite all that, in the next 5 years, global capacity to produce this virgin plastic for single-use plastics is still set to grow by about 30%. Mm-hmm. So this report is urging kind of stop that kind of faucet from pouring and flooding the kitchen.
Yeah, but these companies have incentive to keep that faucet open. You mentioned that plastic, you know, a lot of people don't know, is made from, you know, oil and gas. What's going on with these companies that make it?
Yeah, I mean, this complex, you're talking about oil and chemicals companies, consumer products giants, fast food companies, so many parties. It's largely been allowed to operate in a minimally monitored kind of make, take manner that leaves municipalities, individuals, taxpayers cleaning up the tab. And so the report is urging here that, you know, the bright spot is that it's largely concentrated among a handful of players, right? Or 20 or 30 or 50 players. So if you could stop the cycle of extraction and production, call out the biggest beneficiaries of the status quo, and commence something that resembles a circular economy, much like what we see with the aluminum can and the newspaper and cardboard sectors, Plastics, by contrast, they're literally all over the place. But by calling out the enablers of the status quo right now, it's hoping to kind of group them into what you've seen with the likes of ExxonMobil or BP, and that fossil fuel companies are being called to task, called to the mat for their impact on climate change.
Well, that's going to be tough because as they also, you know, are seeing demand for fossil fuels go down and maybe more in the future, this is a good future for them, plastics, except they're being called out now. And they're being told to commit to a circular plastics economy. Now, the Plastic Waste Makers Index also found that 60% of the commercial financing for these companies that produce this waste comes from just 20 banks. So suddenly we have a spotlight on investors and bankers as well. How can they, be part of the solution here?
Well, they haven't been held accountable. It's been nominal. And therein lies some of the value in calling out the financial enablers in a report like this. You already see it with shareholder activists and fund companies and even universities pressured to divest from oil giants. You see it in Exxon being kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial Average last year. So this hint at transparency takes it another step forward. Here are banking giants such as HSBC and Bank of America transitively backing climate negative fossil fuel extraction by underwriting plastics production. I think that would be a piece of news to a lot of shareholders and banking customers out there. By 2050, the report notes, plastic is expected to account for as much as 10% of greenhouse gas emissions. So that puts a huge target on that industry.
Well, and also we play a role here in just the 30 seconds we have. Stop choosing plastic as a single use when you can do something else, paper or something. But it is a bigger problem than any of us. And now this new report is putting a spotlight on the producers and the investors. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
There will be no criminal charges against police involved in yet another high-profile death of a black man, this time in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. This morning, District Attorney Andrew Womble said police were justified when they shot Andrew Brown Jr., who was in his car when they tried to arrest him on drug charges. Womble said Brown's car came into contact with the officers who had surrounded him.
If he was going to attempt to flee, he had no choice but to drive directly at the officers. When he did that, and he made that decision on his own, he placed their lives in danger.
Joining us now is WUNC reporter Will Michaels. Will, welcome.
Hey, Peter.
Womble showed four police body camera videos for the first time today. Did they make it clear what happened there on April 21st?
They gave a little bit more clarity, but as you said, these were four different body cameras, about 45 seconds from each one of them, and they show officers approaching Andrew Brown in his car, the moments when they shoot and kill him, and then just about the moment that they reach into the car to retrieve his body. This does not show anything before or after that, but as you say, the district attorney, Andrew Womble, his decision hinged on this idea that, as he said, the officers perceived a threat against them, and it was the car that was being used as a deadly weapon. But in his mind, Andrew Womble said, as soon as Andrew Brown did not listen to orders to put his hands up or get out of the car, that's the point at which the car was used as a deadly weapon. So there were some different interpretations of that video inside the briefing room, actually. Reporters asked the district attorney whether or not he thought that Andrew Brown was simply just trying to get away from officers and that they stepped in front of the car. But I think there are still some questions to be answered here. It has given a little bit of clarity, but not everything is answered here.
Right. And sometimes a 44-second video doesn't tell the whole story. So what other questions are people asking today?
Well, from those about a handful of people who were outside the Pasquotank County Courthouse, where I am now, said along those same lines, release the rest of the footage. There is a deep sense of distrust from being here over several days between the people of Elizabeth City and the authorities who are sworn to protect Elizabeth City. And so they want to see the video that exists before and after these 45 seconds that were released. It continues to be calls for release the footage.
And have we heard from Andrew Brown's family today?
I am still waiting to hear back from Andrew Brown's family, but it's worth also mentioning that, you know, this case highlighted a provision in state law that largely keeps body camera footage under wraps in North Carolina, unless it's ordered released by a judge. So that actually hasn't happened. The district attorney said that he was able to show 45 seconds of body camera footage today because he decided not to bring charges against these deputies. But there is still no indication from the judge that this will be released anytime soon, and we are still waiting to hear back from Andrew Brown's family.
One more piece of context here. Andrew Brown was killed on the same day that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of murdering George Floyd. So this comes at a very tense time in our country. WUNC reporter Will Michaels joining us from Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Thank you for your reporting.
Sure thing.
Derek Chauvin was found guilty in the murder of George Floyd. Another jury will determine whether his three fellow Minneapolis police officers should have stopped him. One tried. A body cam shows Thomas Lane asking, should we roll him on his side before being shut down by Chauvin? But Lane was a rookie, on the job just 4 days. Chauvin had 19 years. Lane might have been thinking of other officers like Carriol Horn, a police officer in Buffalo, New York, which had a duty to intervene policy in 2006 when she tried to stop a fellow officer from putting a chokehold on a suspect, and that officer punched her in the face, and she was fired for interfering with his arrest. Well, things may be changing. Buffalo recently made the duty to intervene policy a law. Officers who don't intervene will be charged. And many cities across the country are now teaching officers how to intervene. Some, including New York City and New Orleans, using a program called ABLE, based on the research and often under the direction of Irvin Staub, professor emeritus of psychology at UMass Amherst, who's devoted much of his career to the psychology of intervening. Professor Staub, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Talk about some of your early research. This was at Harvard. You had your assistants drop in the streets, right, and see if someone would come help them. And then children.
Yes. We had a child sit in a room, and they heard a crash and sounds of distress from another room while they're working on a drawing. The youngest children helped less. The first graders helped more. The second graders helped even more than that. And to our surprise and shock, in sixth grade, helping went down to about the level of first graders. And children were saying, I didn't think I was allowed to go into the other room. Already young children learn what are acceptable traditional behaviors. And they are not told that under certain circumstances, caring about others supersedes these other kinds of rules.
Sure, we're taught it's none of your business, don't get involved. It's so fascinating because you then found this in other studies and you can apply it towards not just police officers, but we're understanding a nurse helping a surgeon, a co-pilot who might be of less rank, afraid to say something to a pilot because what, they don't feel they have the permission?
Yes. I initiated this training many years ago after the Rodney King incident, but then we used it extensively in New Orleans, and it was very effective there. Complaints about the police diminished. Unnecessary harmful actions greatly diminished. And then we moved on to create a third version of the training, which is now called ABLE, and we are training over 100 police departments right now.
Okay, you've said a couple things. I want to go back to 1991 after the Rodney King incident, the black man brutally beaten by 4 police officers while 17 other officers looked on. A tape of that event provoked the LA riots. And so the LA department wanted to make change, but you met resistance there. But in New Orleans, the program, which was called, I think, EPIC at that point in New Orleans, it had turned it into a verb. Officers were saying, I epicked my partner, meaning I calmed him down. How did you get officers to address a superior to stop them from doing something that would get them into trouble and cause harm?
We talk about the culture. Normally, police officers learn to support a fellow officer no matter what that officer is doing. We turn it around so that good policing is stopping a fellow officer, both for the sake of citizens, but also for their sake, so that they don't lose their jobs and they are not going to be criminally prosecuted. So before any other officers, we train the leaders of a department so that they sign up for it. Like in the Chauvin case, one officer, as you mentioned, tried to intervene. Well, what we train them is to start such low-level intervention, but if that is not successful, to increase, to say, I'm going to take over, if necessary, also to physically engage, and also to turn to fellow officers who are on the scene and invite them in as allies. We also talk about what inhibits intervention. If there is no culture change, what happens is what happened to that female officer you mentioned, who was retaliated against and lost her job. We want to be sure that that doesn't happen.
How do you get a rookie confronted? We all know what it's like to be in a hierarchy, and when there's someone you just feel you can't question. And then how do you get the senior officer to accept somebody in public saying to him, you know what, take a break, you need a break? That's publicly humiliating for that senior officer in front of bystanders.
That's a perfect question. And part of our training is about accepting intervention. And they even talk about what is the kind of intervention that would be most acceptable to them. So, for example, the superintendent in New Orleans, Michael Harrison, he was wearing this little pin that we give everybody, and he was telling his officers, I am wearing it so that you know that if I do something inappropriate, you can intervene on me. Then also practice this. What do you say? And you do this actually with superior officers. That can change the whole climate in the department. Having a law that requires intervention is not enough.
It's not just about you have to do this. It's the why it's best for you and everyone to do this. And it's practicing doing this. You literally do it several times in a skit way. And also you can fake it. You teach police officers to maybe say to their partner, you know what, I actually need some training on this. Let me try. To save the superior's face and intervene.
Yes, yes. And one more thing, and that is this training has an effect even without intervention. A female officer was arresting somebody, and this person spit in her face. And that's one of the greatest insults to a police officer. Mm. And she didn't retaliate. And afterwards, she told other officers, I epicked myself. People learn not only to stop others, but also the ways that you can stop yourself.
Can you talk a little about your interest in intervention? We understand you were a child in Nazi-occupied Hungary, were with your family nanny, and she protected you.
Well, this wonderful woman, Maria, took me and my sister into hiding. And after a while, Maria thought that other people in the building were getting suspicious, so she took us somewhere else. She was my incredible role model.
You know, she, Professor, didn't have training. Are there just some people who, they will stand up to the Nazis? They will stand up to a bully? Is it just, there's there something that you can't teach?
This is something that some people carry with them as a result of who they are, as a result of their own life experience. Now, in most genocides, most people remain either passive or support the perpetrators. But a very small percentage of people endanger themselves, they endanger their families, including their children.
And so we see how your lifelong study of rescuers, of intervention, started with Maria. You were so young. I just wondered, did you ever have a chance to ask her, why did you do that?
Well, she experienced harsh, bad, harmful behavior from a stepmother. And sometimes we learn from that. But when she was about 89 years old, and I said to her, you know, everything that I do in life has to do with you. And her head was shaking, her hair all white. And she said, to my amazement, I know. It got me too.
Well, what a gift. UMass Amherst Professor Emeritus, expert in the science of intervention, who's now working with police departments, Irvin Staub. Professor Staub, Irvin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I deeply appreciate it.
The debate we're having now over how to regulate social media and what constitutes censorship is similar to a debate that was had at the dawn of the TV era. In the 1950s, corporate sponsors had a lot of control over what screenwriters could and could not say. But one man pushed back. Katie Sewell of the Bittersweet Life podcast has the story.
Do you remember this television show?
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. Just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
That's Rod Serling, and the opening to his renowned television series, The Twilight Zone. You're probably familiar with it, even though there hasn't been a new episode in almost 60 years. What you may not know is that Rod Serling got his start writing for radio at WNYC in the summer of 1946. He started off at the bottom. After all, he had no writing credits to speak of. But eventually he did get a script on the air by entering a radio play writing contest.
From New York City, we bring you a new Dr. Christian Prize play.
Serling won $500 for his script titled To Live a Dream, and that was enough encouragement to keep at it. Later that year, this show bought a script.
Pillsbury Snow Sheen Cake Flour brings you Grand Central Station.
Grand Central Station specialized in romance and light drama. Not exactly what Rod Serling would become known for, but it did earn him credibility as a staff writer in the industry. Rod Serling's writing style was highly influenced by Norman Corwin, a famous writer and director of the Golden Age. Corwin was a master at addressing political and social issues using great poetry. Here's an example.
150 years is a twinkle to a star, but to a man it's time enough to teach six generations what the meaning is of liberty, how to use it, when to fight for it.
Serling also took up social issues in his radio scripts, but his ideas didn't always appeal to the sponsor censors. Like a Christmas story he wrote about an elf hit by shrapnel. The script was rejected, but the network did accept Serling's radio series about a ghostly sister and brother traveling by train after being killed in World War II. They accepted it, with a few changes. The kids were riding on a train, but with their friendly uncle. There was no mention of war, and everyone was alive. It seems the censors got to that idea, too. In 1951, Rod Serling quit radio, and he was happy to leave it behind. Television was on the rise, and Serling strongly believed that radio was digging its own grave by becoming cheap and unbelievable. Serling brought his social ideals to television, and the censors were ready. They removed all of his political statements. They even removed lines like, "Got a match?" if the show's sponsor made lighters. Serling always defended his original scripts, sometimes very publicly. He was asked about that on the Mike Wallace interview show in 1959.
If you have the temerity to try to dramatize a theme that involves any particular social controversy, then you're in deep trouble. I went down fighting, as most television writers do. Better say something than nothing.
When Serling created The Twilight Zone in 1959, critics accused him of escaping into fantasy writing because sponsor censorship had destroyed his fire. He had this response.
I have never written beneath myself. I've never written anything that I didn't want my name attached to. Somebody asked me the other day if this means that I'm going to be a meek conformist. My answer is no. I'm just acting the role of a tired nonconformist.
He may have been tired, but he was also free for the very first time. Serling had negotiated complete artistic control of the Twilight Zone, and the show was a hit. The censors were, at last, silenced. The Twilight Zone was so full of humanity and intrigue that it is still influencing our culture today. You can hear Serling's influence in the writing of Stephen King. You can see it in the directing styles of Tim Burton and M. Night Shyamalan. Many media scholars go so far as to credit Rod Serling with the success of television today. Why? Well, Rod Serling remained working in television when most of his colleagues were fleeing to film. At that time, the industry thought TV would never become a place for serious and entertaining drama. Rod Serling disagreed and stayed put. Here he is speaking with Mike Wallace again.
Is television good?
I think it has promise, Mike. I think this can conceivably be a real art form. And I stick with it because I think it can only improve and can improve tremendously. And I think aims toward that.
Rod Serling spent his entire career pushing back. And by doing so, he helped clear the path. And more importantly, inspired generations of television writers and directors to come. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Sewell.
Wow, just love hearing all that archival sound. Mm-hmm. But Robin, is it right that you actually got to meet Rod Serling yourself?
Lucky me. He was my writing professor. I took his master's class when he was visiting professor at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. And every class, he would turn us into a pillar of salt. He used to say, never let an idea die a burning in your head. Get an idea, do it.
I love it. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.